Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling something really crucial, behavioral and psychiatric emergencies. And the sources we looked at really hammer home this point, the mind and body. They're not separate. What happens mentally affects you physically, and, well, the other way around, too.
Absolutely. It's one system. And our goal today really is to give you a kind of mental shortcut for these situations. We want to define what makes something a behavioral emergency.
Right.
We'll look at the huge range of causes and then really focus on the practical stuff, assessment tools like COSMAP and those crucial communication skills you need when things get intense.
And it gets complex fast, doesn't it? Because sometimes the behavior is just a symptom, maybe of a hidden illness, but what triggers the 911 call is just how that person feels about the situation.
Exactly. And you're often dealing with someone whose feelings are, as the source put it, confused and frayed.
Yeah.
That makes the interaction immediately difficult, legally tricky too.
So that's why things like clear explanations, getting consent if you possibly can, and just spending time with the patient are so important.
Precisely. It's about care, but it's also about documentation and safety for everyone involved. Protects the patient, protects the responder.
Okay, so let's define terms. Behavior itself, our sources say, is pretty straightforward. It's just how people act, right? What they do.
Yeah, basically. And we can split that into two types. There's overt behavior, what you can see. It's open, observable.
Like talking, moving around.
Exactly. And then there's covert behavior. That's the internal stuff, thoughts, hidden meanings, intentions, stuff you can't see directly, but it definitely drives the actions.
Got it. So when does this behavior, overt or covert, become an emergency? There's a distinction here, right? Behavioral versus psychiatric.
Yes, and it's a really important one. A behavioral emergency is essentially when someone's mood, thoughts, or actions mess with their basic functioning, their activities of daily living, ADLs.
So they can't manage day-to-day life, like getting dressed, eating.
Right. They're failing to cope, but it's not necessarily dangerous yet.
Okay, so the psychiatric emergency is where the danger comes in.
That's the key difference. A psychiatric emergency is defined by behavior that poses an immediate threat to the person themselves, their health or safety, or, crucially, to the health and safety of others.
That's the threshold, when danger is present.
Correct. And because you might be dealing with someone who isn't speaking clearly, or maybe they're having delusions, this careful documentation and clear communication we mentioned, it becomes absolutely foundational. You're trying to understand an internal state that might be hidden, intentionally or not.
Okay, so let's talk causes. You said abnormal behavior is usually a symptom. The sources break down the underlying causes into four main groups.
That's right. Four broad categories, though. You know, there's often a lot of overlap in real situations. But thinking in categories helps organize assessment.
Right. So category one, this seems like the most immediately medical one. Biologic or organic.
Exactly. Think of these as problems with the hardware, the brain itself, conditions that directly mess with brain function.
Like?
Well, the big one is hypoxia, lack of oxygen. It can look exactly like acute psychosis sometimes. Also seizures, traumatic brain injury, brain tumors, even the long-term effects of substance use, things physically damaging or altering the brain.
And that's why you always have to rule out medical causes first, even if it looks purely behavioral, because you can't talk someone out of hypoxia.
You absolutely cannot. Treatment is medical first.
Okay, category two is environmental. What does that cover?
This is more about the psychosocial context, things like ongoing high stress, poverty, maybe social isolation, cultural factors that put pressure on someone's ability to cope, the environment they live in.
Category three, acute injury or illness. How's that different from biologic?
It's broader, really. It covers general medical conditions like a severe infection that causes delirium or a sudden traumatic event like a car crash or assault that triggers something like PTSD or an acute anxiety reaction. It's a reaction to a specific event or illness.
Okay. And the last one, category four, is substance related.
Right. Alcohol, illegal drugs, even prescription meds or other substances. And the really key point here, the sources emphasize this, is the shift in thinking.
How so?
We now understand substance use disorder not as a moral failing, but as a complex biologic and psychological problem.
That changes everything in terms of approach, doesn't it?
Completely. If you see it as a disease, not a choice, you approach it with clinical treatment, with compassion, not judgment. And that mindset affects how you try to de-escalate.
Which brings us nicely to assessment. This is where things get unique in psych emergencies, right? The idea that the assessor is the diagnostic instrument.
It's a huge part of it. Your observation, your communication, how you interact, it's all part of the assessment and the initial treatment. You're stabilizing by being there and assessing correctly.
But first things first, even before the mental status check.
Always. Back to basics. Primary survey. Airway, breathing, circulation.
Yeah.
You have to rule out or treat immediate life threats. Is this behavior hiding a medical catastrophe?
Like you said, hypoxia or maybe low blood sugar.
Exactly. Check their oxygen, check their blood glucose, give oxygen, maybe give dextrose if needed, and protocols allow. Treat the medical first.
Okay. So once you've stabilized any immediate medical issues, then you move to the mental status exam. And the sources recommend a framework.
Coast map.
Yes, Coast map. It's a really useful mnemonic just to make sure you cover all the key areas of their mental state systematically. Stops you from missing something crucial in a potentially chaotic scene.
Let's break it down.
C.
Consciousness.
Oh.
Simple enough. Are they alert? Responding? Need shouting or pain to respond?
Oh, well.
Or unresponsive? Orientation. Do they know who they are? Where they are? Roughly the time, the day, the year, you know, the standard A and O questions.
Yeah.
Activity, their motor activity. Are they restless, agitated, pacing, or maybe the opposite, slowed down, catatonic, or just normal speech? How are they talking? Is it pressured really fast? Is it loud, quiet, maybe slurred, hard to understand? Logical thought.
Yeah.
Is a big one. What's the content of their thoughts?
Mm-hmm.
Are they logical? Or are there delusions, paranoia? Importantly, are there suicidal or homicidal thoughts?
Mm-hmm.
Memory, can they remember things? What do they have for breakfast? Can they recall events from earlier? Assess recent and maybe immediate recall.
Mm.
Affect and mood. These are related but different. Mood is the underlying feeling, depressed, anxious, euphoric.
Yeah.
Affect is the outward expression of that mood. Does their face match what they say? Or is their affect flat, blunted, inappropriate?
That mismatch can be a real clue.
Definitely. And finally, P, perception. Are their senses playing tricks? Are they having hallucinations, seeing things, hearing voices, illusions?
Wow. Okay, so Coast Map really forces you to observe and ask about all those different facets. It turns a potentially messy situation into a structured assessment.
Exactly. It guides the conversation and ensures you're basing your next steps on actual findings, not just gut feeling.
So medical side handled, Coast Map assessment underway. Now comes the de-escalation. Trying to calm things down with words before needing anything physical? What are the key techniques?
Well, first off, start open-ended. Ask something like, what's been happening today? Instead of yes, no questions.
Let him talk.
Let him talk.
Yeah.
And listen, actively listen. Show you're listening, nod, make eye contact if appropriate, maybe summarize what they said, and acknowledge their feelings. Don't argue with the feelings, just label them. It sounds like you're really angry, or I can see this is frightening for you.
That validation can be powerful. What about that tip on silence? That seemed counterintuitive.
It does, right?
Yeah.
We often feel like we need to fill silence, but the sources say, don't be afraid of it.
What?
Silence gives the patient space to think, to process. It shows patience. It shows you're not rushing them or judging them. It can actually lower the tension.
Okay. Other crisis skills. General approach.
Stay calm yourself, obviously. Be direct, but non-judgmental. Try to get rid of any disruptive people, family, bystanders who are making it worse.
Create a calm space.
Yeah. If possible, sit down. Being at their physical level helps. Stay with the patient. Don't leave them alone if you can help it. And crucially, never just assume someone is impossible to talk to until you've really tried. Honesty, simple reassurance, sometimes even encouraging a little movement, like suggesting a short walk together, can help burn off nervous energy.
But sometimes words aren't enough or the situation escalates. We need to talk about recognizing potential violence. Dispatch info isn't always the full picture, right?
Not at all. You need your own situational awareness the second you arrive. Look for warning signs.
Such as?
Posture is a big one. Are they sitting really tense, like coiled, pacing back and forth? Speech is getting louder, more critical, directly threatening. Motor activity, are they clenching their fists, grinding their teeth, unable to sit still?
And eye contact. Or lack thereof.
Yeah, avoiding eye contact can be a sign of distress, or sometimes, yeah, it can precede aggression. You need to look at the whole picture.
And if you see those signs stacking up.
Priority shifts.
Yeah.
Assess the immediate safety of the scene for everyone. Maintain a safe distance at least 2 arms lengths is a good rule of thumb. Keep trying verbal de-escalation, but set clear boundaries. I need you to lower your voice. Or, I can't help you if you're threatening me. Be prepared to act if needed.
Which leads us to the extreme end, restraint. When talking fails and there's imminent danger, there are 2 main types, physical and chemical.
Correct. Physical restraint involves physically holding the patient. Chemical involves medication. both our last resorts when other methods fail or the danger is just too immediate.
Let's start with physical. The sources are really strict on the protocols here.
As they should be. It's high risk. First rule, never try alone. You need enough people, ideally four or five, one for each limb and one for the head communication. And you must have a plan discussed beforehand. Everyone knows their role.
And the positioning is critical, you said? Supine, face up.
Always supine, face up. This is non-negotiable.
Why is that so absolute?
Yeah.
What's the risk if they're face down, prone?
The risk is called positional asphyxia, and it can be fatal. If someone is agitated, struggling, maybe obese, and you put them face down, especially with pressure on their back, they literally can't expand their chest enough to breathe properly. Their oxygen levels drop. It's incredibly dangerous.
Wow. Okay.
So the sources are crystal clear. Never hobble tie them, ankles to wrists behind the back.
Yeah.
Never tie ankles and wrists together, period. And never, ever place them prone face down for restraint.
And once restraints are on?
You don't take them off until you reach the hospital or medical control advises. No negotiating. And you must constantly monitor their breathing, their airway, and the circulation in their hands and feet. Check pulses, skin color, temperature, continuously.
Okay, that makes the rationale very clear. What about chemical restraint, using medication?
Also a serious step. It always requires approval from medical control, online or offline, per protocol. And you still need that assessment. Chief complaint, allergies, vitals if possible, history.
What kind of drugs are typically used?
The main classes are benzodiazepines,
mm-hmm.
benzos like midazolam or lorazepam, antipsychotics like haloperidol or ziprasidone, and sometimes antihistamines, mainly for their sedative side effects like diphenhydramine.
Benzos are common because they work well intramuscularly, right, if you can't get an IV?
Exactly. Reliable absorption from an IM injection. The downside is often significant drowsiness, sedation, which can complicate assessment later.
And antipsychotics like haloperidol. You mentioned a caution there.
Big one. Haloperidol especially carries a risk of prolonging the QT interval on an ECG.
Which means?
It could disrupt the heart's electrical rhythm, potentially leading to dangerous arrhythmias, even cardiac arrest. It's a known risk, especially with higher doses or IV use. They can also cause extrapyramidal symptoms, those involuntary muscle movements, tremors, stiffness, and sometimes metabolic issues.
So again, highlights why checking for underlying medical issues first is so vital.
Absolutely.
Lastly, let's touch on two specific conditions that often present as emergencies. First, suicidal ideation.
Yeah. Any patient showing signs of depression needs to be assessed for suicide risk. Ask directly. And interestingly, the sources say patients are often relieved when someone finally asks. It gives them permission to talk about it.
Management.
Simple but absolute. Never leave the patient alone, not for a second, and remove anything they could use to harm themselves. Belts, shoelaces, any potential weapons, pills. Secure the environment.
And the other condition, acute psychosis, when someone's really out of touch with reality.
Yeah, profound thought disorder. The key here is that reasoning often doesn't work. The reality is fundamentally different at that moment.
So what does work?
Keep directions very simple, clear, and consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Speak calmly but firmly. Constantly try to orient them back to reality. We're in the ambulance now. My name is X. I'm here to help you. Keep repeating it gently. If these simple approaches don't work, if they remain highly agitated or unable to grasp reality, that's often the trigger point for considering chemical or physical restraint. So wrapping it all up, managing these emergencies is really about following a hierarchy, isn't it? First, fix the medical oxygen, sugar, any immediate physical problems. Then deploy those specialized communication skills. Listen. Validate. Use Coast Map to assess properly.
Right. De-escalate verbally if at all possible.
Exactly. And only then, if absolutely necessary because of danger, move to those carefully planned safety protocols like restraint using the right techniques.
And one really important variable you mentioned that responders need to consider throughout is the patient's medication history. They might be on antidepressants, antipsychotics, benzos, stimulants, a whole cocktail sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And it's not just what they're prescribed, but crucially, were they taking it?
Why is that so critical?
Because the sources point to a really significant link. Medication non-compliant skipping doses is strongly associated with an increased risk of violence in some individuals with serious mental illness. Understanding if they've missed their meds isn't just background info.
It's predictive.
It's a vital predictive factor. It helps you assess the immediate risk, helps you plan for safety, yours and theirs. It's knowledge that really changes how you perceive and manage the situation.
That's a powerful final thought. Knowing the medication status isn't just a detail, it's potentially a key indicator of imminent risk. Well, thank you for walking us through this incredibly complex but vital topic today.
My pleasure.
We really encourage everyone listening to look further into crisis intervention training and resources. It's knowledge that truly saves lives.